Going nuclear today on the world. I'm Marco Werman. Top U.S. intelligence officials say North Korea has no intention of giving up its nuclear program. The White House has said North Korea is denuclearizing. So is it?
No, it's not.
The real status of nuclear threats today. Also, in Montreal, the satisfaction of literally erasing hate off the walls.
What's going on, guys? Erasing hate here in the back of an elementary school with a swastika. It is Sunday. We're here to remove this before the kids get here on Monday. Let's go!
Activist Corey Fleischer deals with hateful graffiti using his tool of choice, a power washer. That and much more today here on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. Perhaps intelligence should go back to school. That's what President Trump had to say this morning about his top intelligence officials, several of them. It was Trump's Twitter response to their testimony yesterday on Capitol Hill, testimony that contradicted the president's assessment of a lot of things. One example, Trump's claim that Iran has cheated on the nuclear deal negotiated under President Obama. The intelligence chiefs rebutted that. They said that even after Trump pulled out of the deal, Iran has continued to comply. Here's Director of National Intelligence Dan Coats.
We do not believe Iran is currently undertaking activities we judge necessary to produce a nuclear device.
Former Energy Secretary Ernest Moniz was one of Obama's principal negotiators on the nuclear deal. We got Moniz on the line today to talk about that testimony by the intelligence chiefs and to ask him what he thinks Iranian scientists have been up to in recent months.
First, let me say, Marco, that everything I know certainly supports their conclusion of Iran complying with the agreement and certainly not developing a nuclear weapon. The scientists are, in fact, carrying out the activities that are both allowed and specified in the agreement. And maybe it's worth a reminder that the fundamental structure of the agreement is that they have significant constraints on what they can do for 15 years. And then beyond that, when those constraints come off, they are in perpetuity part of an extraordinarily tough verification regime. Now, the hope, of course, was that over those 15 years, we would, in fact, be able to build more confidence in our nuclear relationship. But if we don't, the deal was not based upon trust. It was based upon verification, and we would have that forever. So basically, again, direct answer to your question is the scientists are doing what they were, in fact, allowed to do and specified to do in the agreement.
So let's go back to last May. This is President Trump nixing the deal, calling it defective at its core.
A constructive deal could easily have been struck at the time, but it wasn't. At the heart of the Iran deal was a giant fiction that a murderous regime desired only a peaceful nuclear energy program. Today, we have definitive proof that this Iranian promise was a lie.
Very different, given the testimony we heard yesterday in the Senate that Iran was in fact complying with the deal, even after the U.S. withdrew from it. But at the same time, Iran—
May I add, Marco, I would say we have definitive proof, in fact, that they are complying with the agreement.
So at the same time, Iran's military budget is growing. Do you think it has given up totally its nuclear ambitions?
The conclusion drawn for a long time by our intelligence community quite publicly and by the IAEA, and in fact verified by the documents that the Israelis acquired, that Iran did have a structured nuclear weapons program up to 2004, some activities for another five years or so, but certainly no evidence since then of government support for any kind of weapons program.
Yesterday, before the Senate committee, CIA Director Gina Haspel said that Iranian leaders were considering steps that would lessen their adherence to the agreement. What was she referring to?
It's clear there have been statements made, including in public, that, we should think about restarting enrichment programs. Maybe we should think about going to higher levels of enrichment. That has come from the head of the Atomic Energy Organization, who was my essentially co-negotiator. But it's one thing to put those out. And of course, we all recognize that they, like everybody else, have their own internal political dynamics. The important part, again, as far as I know, and I think as was reaffirmed by Directors Haspel and Coates is that they are not carrying out any of those activities that would be outside the agreement.
Former Energy Secretary Ernest Moniz was a key member of the American negotiating team that struck the JCPOA, better known as the Iran nuclear deal. Secretary Moniz, thank you very much for your time today.
Thank you, Marco.
Another area where President Trump and his intelligence agencies don't see eye to eye, North Korea. Director of National Intelligence Dan Coates said yesterday that current North Korean activities are, quote, inconsistent with full denuclearization. He also said North Korea is unlikely to ever give up its nuclear weapons because they're critical to the survival of Kim Jong-un's regime. Trump, by contrast, has made exaggerated claims about North Korean disarmament. So is there any reason to be optimistic? Joe Cerencioni is president of the Plowshares Fund, a global security foundation in Washington. What does North Korea have in terms of nuclear weapons today?
Well, they tested a hydrogen bomb in the first year of the Trump administration, and shortly thereafter, they tested long-range ballistic missiles that could carry that device to just about any city in the United States. So they have a sophisticated, though small, nuclear arsenal, probably enough material for somewhere around 20 nuclear weapons and the missiles to deliver them, certainly in the region and probably to the United States.
What exactly has changed over the past year since the Trump administration began engaging with North Korea?
The prospects of war in the Korean Peninsula have tremendously decreased, and this is the major benefit. You remember in 2017, while they were doing this testing, Donald Trump was talking about fire and fury, comparing nuclear buttons. There was the increasing risk that we would go to war either intentionally or by blunder or miscalculation. That is no longer considered a serious possibility. There has not been a serious North Korean provocation in over 420 days. They haven't tested missiles of any kind. They haven't tested nuclear weapons anymore. The temperature has dropped dramatically. The opportunity for a deal that could lead to a lasting peace is there. Whether we're able to realize that opportunity is an open question.
As you know, we keep hearing from the White House and Trump that North Korea is denuclearizing.
No, it's not. They've stopped testing, which is a very good step. Kimmon says this isn't just a pause. He says he stopped testing. He also said in his New Year's speech that he wasn't going to produce nuclear weapons anymore. Maybe, but all of this is unverified. So the purpose of an agreement would be to start putting in inspections, verification procedure, timelines, declarations of assets, you know, something that starts to look a lot more like the Iran deal than I think the Trump administration would like to admit. That is action for action, step by step. You do this, and then we will relax some sanctions. You do this, and we will sign a peace treaty. And in that process, in that iterative process, you start to overcome the decades of mistrust between all the parties involved.
So unverifiable claims from the White House. Joe Cerencioni, how problematic do you find it that President Trump does not appear to accept the conclusions of his intelligence apparatus?
The president lives in his own world. He rejects the advice of our intelligence leaders, of our own allies. He seems to form his opinion based on a few leaders that he likes and Fox News. The president of the United States at this point has got to be considered a major security threat to the country. What he's doing and how he is doing it is so unpredictable, is so unstable, is so potentially dangerous. And remember, at any moment, the president and the president alone has unchecked ability to launch a nuclear weapon. At any time, for any reason, he can pick up the phone and order a nuclear strike. This is a situation that we have tolerated for years because we trusted the president of the United States to have good judgment. I would say that trust is no longer there.
So with the talk of a new Kim-Trump summit as soon as next month, maybe in Vietnam, what do you expect to come out of this summit and what needs to come out of it?
I am cautiously optimistic for several reasons. Kim Jong-un wants a breakthrough. He needs this summit to be a success. Trump needs a victory out of here. So he can't replay the vague declarations of the Singapore summit. It's got to be more substantive.
Joe Cerencioni, president of the Plowshares Fund, thank you very much.
Thank you for having me.
The intel chiefs yesterday were briefing the Senate on their annual worldwide threat assessment. That's a document that maps out the big security threats around the globe. On Afghanistan, a short summary, but the word stalemate stands out. Meantime, Afghanistan's government is not at the table as the U.S. tries to talk peace with the Taliban. That is a big mistake, says Ryan Crocker. He's a former U.S. ambassador to Afghanistan.
I think we are on very treacherous ground right now. We should not have another meeting with the Taliban unless or until the Afghan government is going to be part of the talks. If we continue with the Taliban only, we will be effectively surrendering the country to the Taliban. It will just be a question of time.
So why do you think the United States agreed to these ground rules for peace talks without the Afghan government?
For years, that has been the terms of the Taliban, ready to talk to us anytime, but never with the Afghan government, which they see as illegitimate. So we caved, we conceded to their primary condition, and I can only assume that this administration wants to get out at any cost. This is also accompanied by the president's statement that he wants to cut the remaining force in half. So it looks to me like this administration has said, we're done. Let's dress it up as best we can in terms of an agreement, but we're leaving. That is very dangerous.
So the U.S. envoy, Zalmay Khalilzad, I mean, he's no slouch when it comes to this part of the world. What kind of mission has he been sent on? What are his marching orders?
I fear that he has been sent on a mission impossible. You're right. You know, no one knows this area better than him, certainly. He didn't make this up on his own. So I have to assume that by sitting down with the Taliban without the government of Afghanistan, those are his instructions. Get the best deal you can any way we can because we're leaving.
Which is not a great position to be in. I mean, you're dealing from a position of weakness, not of strength.
Well, Marco, that's exactly the point. Again, it's what we saw with the Paris peace talks.
With Vietnam.
And this simply brings back those – with Vietnam. This brings back those memories for those of us old enough to remember it.
What is the analogy with the Vietnam peace talks? That was in 1973.
We surrender. We're going home. What we want is a decent interval so that everybody can change the channel. And when the ultimate defeat of South Vietnam takes place, it'll be a couple of years out and won't look so blatantly like the surrender we are, in fact, talking about. And that's what we got. And the images of helicopters lifting off from the roof of the American embassy.
So here we're facing another long war, this one in Afghanistan. I don't know anyone who wants the war to continue. So what is the alternative?
Let's remember, we're down to about 14,000 troopers in Afghanistan. When I left in 2012, we had well over 100,000. With those 14,000 and our NATO allies, who also have significant troops on the ground, the Afghan government is rocking along. They control all of the provincial capitals. They control most of the main roads. They are not about to themselves surrender. But if we do, they're not going to have much of a choice. So for the commitment of 14,000 troops in advisory roles almost exclusively, the situation is manageable. That is not a bad investment in my view.
Ambassador, we've been having this whole discussion with the assumption that the Taliban would take over, will take over if U.S. troops pull out. Why are you so certain about that?
With us pulling out, we are sending the signal that we can't win. We're done. We've basically lost. That will give a huge shot in the arm to the Taliban. And correspondingly, it is going to dramatically weaken both the abilities and the resolve of the Afghan government itself. The significance of the American role cannot be overstated.
Ryan Crocker, the former U.S. ambassador to Afghanistan, thanks very much for your time. Really appreciate it.
Thank you.
The father of mindfulness prepares for the next life. That story just ahead here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. You may have spotted over the last few days in your social media feeds a picture of a Buddhist monk. Thich Nhat Hanh is his name. He's Vietnamese, was a friend of Martin Luther King Jr. and a key figure during the Vietnam War. His writings and teachings and lessons are revered around the globe. Right now, his followers are watching as he hovers near death. As The World's Rupa Shenoy reports, Hanh has been hailed by American presidents and celebrities.
He's been called the father of mindfulness.
You surrender yourself to the present moment.
Thich Nhat Hanh is credited with bringing Buddhism to the West. He was born in Vietnam 92 years ago and trained as a Buddhist monk against his parents' wishes. In 1960, he left to teach Buddhism at Columbia and Princeton as Vietnamese soldiers were training for the battlefield and the anti-war and anti-draft movements gathered momentum in the U.S. In 1963, Americans watched a Buddhist monk set himself on fire in the middle of a busy Saigon intersection to protest the communist government's repression. It was a pivotal moment. Suddenly, Americans wanted to know more about what was happening in Vietnam. Thich Nhat Hanh was there to explain. He became an anti-war activist, leading risky missions into Vietnam. He traveled the world to gather support for peace, addressing the British, Canadian, and Swedish parliaments. And he met with Martin Luther King. Afterward, King came out against the Vietnam War and later nominated Hanh for a Nobel Peace Prize. Hanh went on to lead a Buddhist delegation to the Paris peace talks.
It was during the last years of the Vietnam War. We lived together in the same little house in Paris.
Penelope Faulkner is the United Buddhist Church of Vietnam's deputy director in Paris. In the early 70s, Faulkner was a teenage volunteer. She says Hanh was the voice of the Vietnamese to the international community.
He said that Vietnamese wanted a solution to the war which was not made in Moscow or made in Beijing or made in even Washington, you know, but the Vietnamese wanted their own way.
Their coalition was short-lived.
The difference came especially when in 1975, when the Vietnam War ended,
Americans left and a communist government took control in Vietnam.
And at that time, Thich Nhat Hanh was silent. And, you know, boat people were leaving Vietnam in the thousands and dying on the seas in their quest for freedom.
It's believed more than 200,000 Vietnamese have drowned at sea trying to reach foreign soil.
And we thought that if you're talking about compassion and peace, this is the time to do it. And Thich Nhat Hanh was not ready to do that, you know. So at that point of our organization, we sort of gently parted company, although, you know, in mutual respect.
The communist government banned Hanh from coming back. Vietnamese outside their home country were suddenly refugees.
My name is Nguyen Ba Chung, and I'm a retired person.
Nguyen Ba Chung is a writer and translator who taught at the University of Massachusetts in Boston. He was stranded in the U.S. when he was in college.
Buddhism was the thing that saved me during the time.
What helped were books of poetry by Thich Nhat Hanh. Hanh was prolific.
Every one of them strike something very, you know, wonderful, you know, when you read it. It point to something true.
Hanh also founded a monastery in southern France and lectured around the world. He helped fuel a whole mindfulness industry with celebrity fans like Richard Gere and Oprah Winfrey. In 2005, the Vietnamese government invited him back, and he went, again drawing criticism from people like Penelope Faulkner.
His presence in Vietnam, unwittingly maybe for him, gave the impression to the international community that Vietnam was respecting religious freedom, when in fact it was a time of repression.
Hanh said he talked to the Vietnamese president about that and advocated for the dissolution of the country's feared religious police. His appeal didn't work. As soon as Hanh left Vietnam, his followers were punished. Nguyen Ba Chung says Hanh was walking a fine line and tried his best.
Anybody who condemned him from not speaking out against the government, I don't think that that's really fair when that's the consequences of its action.
Hanh arrived in Vietnam for a final visit in late October. He's reportedly stopped taking the medication he was prescribed after he had a stroke 3 years ago. Hanh's staying in the monastery where he took his vows as a monk when he was 16. Now he says he's ready to move on, which Nguyen Ba Chung totally understands.
Buddhism doesn't consider death to be something to be feared. Death is a normal transition into another stage of life. You know, they believe in rebirth, you know. And until you attain enlightenment, that could free yourself from rebirth.
Hanh hung a piece of his own calligraphy on the wall above him. It says, simply, return. For The World, I'm Rupa Shenoy.
Right now, the polar vortex has a huge part of the U.S. gripped in dangerously cold temperatures. Authorities in several states have issued dire warnings against even going outside. For the homeless, it is a huge concern in many places today. In Canada, a wind chill in Toronto, for example, is minus 21 Fahrenheit today. Patricia Muller runs Homes First Society, a nonprofit that works with the homeless in Toronto.
What happens when it's this cold is we have an extreme weather alert. Some of the shelters, they have buildings with other uses. They wake people up, feed them breakfast, and then say that they can't come back till 5 o'clock, for example. Ours are open 24/7, so we don't ask people to leave in the morning. When it's an extreme cold weather alert, the city wants agencies to relax any of its rules so that people aren't out in the street in the cold all day.
Some people in Toronto are arguing that the city should declare a state of emergency. Mueller isn't convinced that will actually make a difference to the people her group serves.
It's more of a matter of semantics. From what I understand, the federal government wouldn't say, okay, there you get $50 million just for declaring. I think it speaks to the fervor of the people that really care about this, wanting it to be called that. But I don't think it's going to unlock any new funding sources or revenue streams, which is really what's needed to develop deeply affordable housing with high supports.
The latest data on Toronto's homeless population is from November, when the city estimated that just under 9,000 people are homeless there. Some of Toronto's homeless shelters specialize their services for people with mental health and addiction issues. Mueller says during extreme weather conditions, they make room for everyone, regardless of their situation.
Our specialty is when a person's been kicked out of every shelter, it seems, we say send them to us. We like to deal with people with addiction issues and mental health issues, and that's our particular niche.
That same data from November says that about 40% of Toronto's homeless are refugees or asylum seekers. Mueller thinks there's a gap in the services available for refugees, but sometimes it's a matter of connecting people to the right places for help.
Many of these refugees weren't always being connected with the services right away, so they would someone would bring them to shelters like our agencies. Our agency would quickly realize this person's going to need some immigration services, and then we try to get them set up to be connected to Sojourn House, and they actually specialize in refugees and asylum seekers.
Patricia Mueller with Homes First Society in Toronto. When it is this cold out, she says, they accommodate everyone who needs a way to get inside for the night. I'm Marco Werman. Protesters hit the streets again in Venezuela today. The country is locked in a power struggle, and at the center, people trying to figure out a way forward.
I think it's a crisis of the Venezuelan society, but I think that there is no way we can solve it by ourselves.
One protester's perspective from Caracas. That's still ahead here on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and this is The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH here in Boston. Venezuelans protesting on the streets of Caracas today. They want President Nicolas Maduro to step down and hand power to Juan Guaido, who was recognized last week by the U.S. and others as Venezuela's interim president. The standoff between the two leaders is getting more tense every day. Maduro has dismissed calls for new presidential elections and accused Guaido of staging a U.S.-directed coup. Maduro also told a Russian news agency that if the U.S. and others wanted a fresh vote, they would have to wait until 2025. Today's protests took place at various points around Caracas. The turnout was not as large as last week's demonstrations, but Venezuelans remain determined to get their voices heard. Mariana Zambrano is a doctor in Caracas. She was at the protests earlier today, but had to go back to work. Dr. Zambrano, is this the first time you've gone out to protest?
No. I was in the January 23rd protest, and I have been in many protests in the past because I think that this regime was imposed on us, and they need to get out because the economic crisis, the health crisis, everything in the country is pretty much a mess.
Mariana Zambrano, you're a doctor. What kind of doctor are you?
Right now, I'm doing residency in internal medicine.
What's it been like for you with all these reports of shortages of medicine and hospital equipment?
It's horrible, actually. It's pretty hard to treat patients when you don't have the medicines. It's hard to even prescribe anything because they either can't get it because they can't find it, or they can't afford it. So it's a real, real issue. And that's only the tip of the iceberg. I mean, there are shortages of physicians and nurses. Everything is pretty chaotic. Like, getting proper healthcare, it's pretty hard for the standard population.
How do you cope as a doctor? I mean, have you had to send patients home and say, I'm sorry, we don't have that medicine or we can't help you?
Yeah. Like, you give them options. Like, you can buy it at some place, or you have to go and get it somehow, or we can't treat you. So
how do you cope with that?
Well, it's pretty difficult. You do the math. I mean, it's overwhelming. You want to help out and do your best, do your job mainly. And the circumstances make it nearly impossible because you get an overload of emotion because you know that the people are the ones that are suffering. Like, you give them more stress because they don't have to deal only with the stress of their illness. They also have to deal with the stress of the whole situation that, like, they don't have food. Most of the people have really, really, a really hard time getting a proper nutrition. So that has a huge influence on their capacity to recover from an illness. So that only makes treatment even longer and harder, and it's pretty hard.
What good does it do to protest?
Actually, I think that we need to show somehow both the military and the international community that there is a misconception that there is a polarization in Venezuela. I don't think that's actually true. I think there is a majority that is against the government, and there is a minority of people that are there supporting the regime because of different reasons.
What was the mood among the protesters?
The mood of the people, I think it's people want out of this regime. So that's what they are calling for. They are calling for him to step out and leave current President Guaido take charge and do what he has to do, which is call for an election as soon as that is possible.
Dr. Zambrano, what do you want to happen in Venezuela?
It's complicated. I want the Maduro regime to step out, and I want someone else to take power and hopefully take the right political measurements to change the whole system. So I think that hopefully the new administration that takes power, if that comes to happen, should take the right decisions to make it possible. The thing is, for that to happen, even though I wish for it peacefully, it's hard. I wish it was done peacefully, but right now the government has shown that they won't leave power peacefully. They will do anything in their power to stop it. So
there are some people who feel that this crisis in Venezuela needs to play out and be managed by Venezuelans and only Venezuelans. Do you welcome the outside world, or is this a crisis for just Venezuelans to solve?
No, I think it's a crisis of the Venezuelan society, but I don't think we can handle it by ourselves because we have tried. But the government has made sure that all the legal mechanisms for us to solve it are annihilated. So we don't have the means. I honestly think that if it was a matter of us and only us, we would have been out of this regime a long time ago. But I think that there is no way we can solve it by ourselves, unfortunately.
Mariana Zambrano, a physician in Caracas, she took part in today's protests against Nicolas Maduro. Mariana Zambrano, thank you very much.
You're welcome. Thank you.
You can find photos of today's protests and more ongoing Venezuela coverage at theworld.org. One key to the political and economic meltdown in Venezuela? Oil. It accounts for 95% of Venezuelan exports, and despite years of turmoil, President Maduro's government has had a lifeline, the U.S.-based oil company, Citgo.
Couldn't your car use a little extra insurance, like the protection of Citgo Extra Range Motor Oil? It's blended with additives.
An old Citgo commercial there from 1970. Citgo is a subsidiary of Venezuela's state oil company, PDVSA. It imports heavy crude oil from Venezuela and then refines and distributes it in the U.S. The Trump administration froze that cash flow to the Venezuelan government this week. Scott Modell is a managing director of Rapidan Energy Group. He's also a former CIA officer in Latin America.
Citgo has been a critical revenue generator for PDVSA and the Venezuelan government for a long time. It's a company that's worth billions of dollars. It's the largest single buyer of Venezuelan crude in the United States. And lately, because domestic refineries in Venezuela are operating at such a low percentage of capacity, Citgo has been the largest provider of gasoline to Venezuela. Also critical is Citgo provides diluents for blending heavy and extra heavy Venezuelan crude. So about 60 to 100,000 barrels a day have been flowing from the United States to Venezuela, and Citgo has been playing a role in that as well.
I know the price per gallon of gasoline in Venezuela was one of the lowest in the world. Is it still?
It still is extremely low, and people that I know who are there, including some of the folks who just recently returned from the U.S. Embassy, said that when they used to go and fill up their tanks, the gas station attendants would say, just pay me whatever you can. So literally, in some cases, gas is either free or very, very close to it, despite the crisis and hyperinflation.
And over the past decade or so, what kind of relationship has the state oil company PDVSA had with Venezuela's leaders like Hugo Chavez and Nicolas Maduro?
It's been very critical. In 2002, there was a massive oil worker strike against Chavismo and against Chavez. It was a tough time for Chavez. He solidified power. And one of the first things he did was to clear out PDVSA to make sure that that was no longer an anti-revolutionary organization. And he gutted it. And since then, it has been a critical part of the power base in Venezuela and the entire Chavez establishment. And, you know, despite the last 3 or 4 years of significant deterioration of Venezuela's oil sector, during which time people have expected another round of major oil worker strikes, that has not happened. When you look at the oil workers' unions and you look at who is working there, there is no internal push against Maduro. PDVSA is not going to suddenly become a political actor that works with Guaido and puts pressure on Maduro.
We've seen political tension between Washington and Caracas for a long time now, but the economic relationship and this oil relationship didn't really seem to suffer. Citgo always seemed to somehow be insulated from the problems. Why is that?
You know, when Donald Trump was elected, this goes back further than that, but I'll just fast forward to 2016. When Donald Trump was elected, Marco Rubio and a few others brought one of the opposition leader's wives, Leopoldo Lopez's wife, Lilian Tintura, to the White House and made the case and said, we have a real problem and we actually need to do something we haven't done before, raise pressure to the next level and bring about regime change in Venezuela. And since then, the administration has tried to strike the balance between ramping up pressure, but not wanting to throw Venezuela into a worse humanitarian catastrophe than it already is in. The decision on January 10th of this year, however, for Maduro to swear himself in for another 5 years tipped the administration over to the point where it could no longer rely solely on individual sanctions. And they decided, obviously, as you saw, to go right to the energy sector. And they've crossed the Rubicon, so to speak. And I think they're now heading to a place where they're not going to stop until Maduro is gone.
Right. Just this week, the Trump administration announced that it would block all U.S. revenue to PDVSA. So, I mean, what's the goal there and what effect could it have?
Well, the impact, I think what they're trying to do, and it's very similar to what they do in the case of Iran, is to cut off the streams of revenue to the regime, to Maduro and the regime, but they want to keep barrels flowing. And this is very complicated because it's going to force Maduro and PDVSA to reroute 400,000 or 500,000 barrels a day that were going to the United States to India and China and elsewhere. So it's making it harder and more expensive for PDVSA to do business, and it's trying to redirect revenue streams to the interim president.
Do you think Citgo has a role to play in helping Venezuela out of this crisis?
That's the subject of real debate in Venezuela among the political opposition. It has been for some time, and even here in D.C. The debate is, to what extent should it? And I think everybody agrees Citgo makes complete sense in any petroeconomic recovery plan. It's worth several billion dollars. It is a key part of PDVSA's external operations, and it's a great revenue generator. So I think everybody agrees, Citgo, we have to remove it as a source of revenue for Maduro in the short run, but in the long run, it's an important piece in the overall economic recovery plan that's going to bring Venezuela back on its feet.
Can you imagine like a timeline for that?
I mean, I guess there's two questions on the timeline. One is, how long does it take for this to play out? For either Maduro to hunker down and stay and us to go through for more rounds of escalation between the U.S. and Venezuela, or if Maduro goes, how long is it going to take for this recovery to take place? And in the latter, to get back to Venezuela's comfortable place where it had been up until 3 or 4 years ago at about 2.5 million barrels a day, it's going to take at least 3 to 5 years.
Scott Modell, the managing director of Rapidan Energy Group, speaking with us about the role of oil in Venezuela's political situation. Thank you.
Thank you, Marco.
The Defense Department this week announced plans to send more troops to the U.S.-Mexico border. They would join some 2,400 military personnel already deployed there. President Trump has argued they're needed to help stop caravans of migrants coming up from Central America. But the reality is, the government agency charged with security at the border, Customs and Border Protection, is seriously short-staffed. Despite Trump's promise 2 years ago of a hiring surge, thousands of Border Protection jobs are still vacant. John Monahan is with us. He has an up-close view of the situation on the border. He's a Customs and Border Protection officer and Union Chapter president, and he's with us from his home in El Paso, Texas. Officer Monahan, I understand you've been with the force for 16 years. What is your day-to-day like?
Well, as the chapter president, day-to-day normally, I deal with what the employees need and meeting with management about important things at work. As a CBP officer, though, we work at the bridge on a daily basis at the port of entry, whether it's in passenger or cargo processing.
So you look at what employees need. Is there a personnel shortage problem where you work?
We've always had a personnel shortage problem here. We have a big attrition rate. People come to the southwest border, and it's not exactly what they were looking forward to, so they end up leaving. You really don't have a life here. You're working 99% of your time, and even on your days off, you're just trying to recuperate from the days that you were working. But we also have a problem with hiring.
In what sense? People don't want to work for CBP?
Well, no. We're losing a lot of people to the polygraph test. So in order to qualify, you have to pass a polygraph test. But for whatever reason, we're losing a lot of people.
Why is a polygraph test needed for officers for Customs and Border Protection?
I have no idea. This was a congressional decision. We didn't make that. And to be honest with you, I don't think that it's working. They believe that by administering polygraph tests, they're going to weed out all of the bad people. But bad people are going to get through no matter what.
How does the personnel shortage affect you and your union?
We're forced to do overtime. I mean, overtime is a condition of our employment. We understood that. But sometimes there's such a thing as too much. There'll be days where the person is ordered 2-3 times in a row to do 16 hours at a time. You know, that's sort of a little bit much.
I know your union, the National Treasury Employees Union, sued the Trump administration over the shutdown. Now that the shutdown is over, do you see a lingering effect on morale?
I think it's going to be there for a little while. And if it so happens that on the February the 15th it happens again, it'll be amazingly bad.
The Defense Department, as you know, just announced plans to send a couple more thousand troops to the border. How will that help you?
I'm not sure that it will. I mean, all they can do is they can be here as a deterrent, or if he's going to have them build some sort of a wall, they can build that. But they can't really do our job. They don't have the authority.
They can't do your job because you at CBP, you work a port of entry, and that wouldn't help you there, right?
Right. All they can do is be a deterrent for people, you know, trying to storm the border.
Yeah, so what solutions do you see to your personnel shortage?
I don't know. I mean, we just got to keep plugging, keep hiring, keep searching for the right people. Once we get the right people, I mean, they stay. I mean, I've stayed, and I have many friends that joined here with me. So it's just a matter of getting the right people, the people that can deal with it, I guess.
John Monahan is an officer with the Customs and Border Protection and the local union chapter president of the National Treasury Employees Union in El Paso, Texas. John Monahan, thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you.
Erasing hate, if only it were that easy with an eraser, you know. This guy actually does make it look that easy.
What's going on, guys? Erasing hate here in the back of an elementary school.
That's Corey Fleischer, and here's what you see in that Instagram video. Bald white guy, mid-30s, ripped. He's wearing a tactical vest and army fatigue pants, and he's in front of a brick wall at an elementary school where someone spray-painted a swastika.
It is Sunday. We're here to remove this before the kids get here on Monday. Let's go!
Fleischer literally blasts it off the wall with a power washer. Corey Fleischer's Instagram account is called Erasing Hate, and he's posted hundreds of videos like that one. So far, his account has more than 53,000 followers.
So this is a movement that basically started here in Montreal that has now grown like a wildfire right around the world. And basically what it is people report any hate that they see anywhere in the world. And then within 24 to 48 hours, that hate will be removed for you free of charge. And, you know, it started off as something that I was doing here in Montreal and started posting some of my videos, some of my content on Facebook and on Instagram, and started getting a lot of phone calls of people around the world asking me to help them, and kind of figured out that it's almost easier for me to erase hate on the other side of the world than it is for me to actually do it here in Montreal.
So, Corey, you're a power washer by trade. I mean, you must have like a huge Rolodex of other power washers around the world, like if some graffiti pops up in Melbourne, Australia. Do you know somebody there who can clean it up?
You know, the Rolodex really realistically doesn't need to be power washers or graffiti removers. What we're starting to see is a lot of regular people who have never done anything with any sort of removals or nothing to do with power washing, nothing to do with anything, kind of stepping in to do these removals. And it's inspiring a lot of people. And when you're actually doing the removal, the feeling you get empowers you.
When you say, Corey, that it's easier to erase graffiti around the world, what do you mean by that?
Well, I mean, okay, so, you know, just for instance, you know, we're talking Australia 3 minutes ago. I mean, I did a removal last week in Australia. It took me 45 minutes to do it. So what will happen is if it's here in Montreal, I have to get to my shop. I have to grab my truck and then I have to basically get out to where that hate is. Okay. It could take within an hour to 2 hours. Last week in Australia, I put down on my social media the location, the tools that they needed to erase a markered swastika that was on a bench. And within 45 minutes, it was gone.
I mean, it's sad to say, but this could turn into a full-time gig for you.
Oh, no, this is a full-time gig. This is something that I'm doing 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. And when I tell everybody, you know, I eat hate for breakfast, I'm eating hate for lunch, I'm eating hate for dinner, and when I go to bed at night, I'm dreaming about hate.
It doesn't sound like necessarily a pleasant experience living with so much hate in your life.
You know what? I mean, you could look at it as a negative way and you could look at it as a positive way, right? So I feel empowered and I feel complete, and it really gives me a sense of, you know, of just, it's really hard to explain. But when you're there and you're removing it so that the next person comes by and doesn't have to see that, for me, I see it as a positive.
How did you start doing this? Like, do you remember the first time you intentionally said, that swastika's got to go, I'm scrubbing it down?
Yeah. One day I was here in Montreal, I was driving, we were in a very busy part of the city. I stopped at a light, and on a cinder block underneath that light was a spray-painted swastika on the cinder block. And, you know, I'm in my truck, I had all the tools in order to remove it, and I wish the story was that I hopped out of my truck and I whipped out my power washer and I removed my very first piece of hate, but that's not what happened. I drove by it. And the second that I drove by it, I had this terribly guilty feeling. I knew that I did something wrong and I felt sick with myself. I couldn't believe that I had the power to make a difference and that I didn't. And so I ended up going to my job, and around 2 to 3 hours later, I had this epiphany moment where I told everybody to pack up their stuff. I sent everybody home. I went back to that swastika and I removed it. And so that 15 seconds that it took me to remove that was something that I was searching for my whole life. I actually spent a lot of my life completely lost. I spent a lot of my life searching for completion. And that 15 seconds finally made me feel complete. And I didn't know how, but I knew that I needed that feeling again. And so what I would do is I would come home from work. I would, you know, take a shower, I'd grab my dog, and now I'm driving around the city looking for anything that I could find that was flagrant or demeaning towards any minority. And in the first 5 years, I removed 50 pieces, around 10 a year. I found myself and I removed myself. And so now with hundreds of thousands of people out there looking for it, it's much easier.
You do this with your dog?
I don't do the actual removal with the dogs, but, you know, I go searching with my dogs. So, you know, animals and dogs are a big part of my life.
I got to ask you one more thing, Corey, about the videos themselves. You clearly have something of a shtick. You look like a tough guy. You sound like an ESPN sportscaster.
What's going on, guys? Erasing hate back at this skate park. It's minus a million degrees outside. Want to thank everybody for pointing out that I missed the KKK. We don't leave hate behind. Yep.
Then you've got the soft side.
First, guys, thank you very much for watching. Until the next time, we love you. And until the next time, you guys know it, we love you. We love you. Until the next time, we love you.
You know what? I mean, look, I think this all started off how people look at me. You know, a lot of people tell me that that I don't look like the friendliest guy, and that when they're walking on the street, if they didn't know me, that they would cross the street.
You got kind of a Vin Diesel thing going.
Yeah. You know, it's like I'm bald. I'm a bigger guy. But, you know, if you got to know me, and if you ask anybody who knows me, they'll tell you that my look does not match my attitude and who I am as a person. And look, I feel that erasing hate started off of me being, you know, an emotional person, a sensitive person, a person that's able to see things from other angles. And, you know, I could be erasing, you know, a 6-foot swastika listening to the Backstreet Boys. You know, I have a women's studies degree from university. You know, and I'm out here erasing swastikas and hate speech around the world. So if that doesn't prove to you that you can do whatever you want in life, then I don't know what does.
Corey Fleischer is the man behind the Instagram account Erasing Hate, and it is much more than an Instagram account, as you say. Corey, thanks a lot.
I appreciate you having me. Thank you very much.
You can find some of Corey's photos and videos on our Instagram. Follow us at PRI The World. Before we go today, we sadly have to pay tribute to someone who is a key part of us here at The World. Even though she didn't spend much time in the newsroom, every day though, you hear me sign off from the Nan and Bill Harris studios. Nan is Joanna Harris, and last weekend she passed away after a long and rich life. Nan was an environmentalist from a young age. She gifted her force and passion for life generally to her children and grandchildren and all those who knew her. She's also survived by her husband, Bill, the other name over our studio door. Nan Harris, from all of us here at The World, you are still with us and always will be. That's our show today. We'll be back with you tomorrow.
PRI, Public Radio International.